Seeing through the myth was liberating. All my American heroes, whom I idolized, had feet of clay and were fallible humans. This was incredibly good news, because that meant that the marble monuments I walked among in D.C., enshrining those who had done consequential things, were human, just like you and me. Revering these leaders as demigods meant I had incorporated them into my identity and mythos of what it meant to be patriotic. I had to defend and justify their flaws, which was unfair to their humanity and made my identity fragile. This quaking at midlife offered a decision. Cling to crumbling identities or courageously question assumptions. Albeit on wobbly legs, I chose courage.
Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community.
Greetings, Ken Woodward here. This is a solo episode where I dive into the backstory of how I ended up standing in front of the White House after walking 2,085 miles for social justice. It is a story of curiosity, questions, dread, and renewal. I offer a trigger warning that this is an unflinching look during my re-evaluation of American history that includes a blunt conversation about racism and a brief discussion about lynching just after the 8-minute mark. Thank you for being here and listening to my story. I was raised in homogeneous central Arizona, where I became a Christian, adopted my dad's conservative political views, and joined the Navy after high school. God was leading the Republicans to vanquish the evil Democrats, and the noble U.S. of A. was bound to defeat the menacing Soviet Union. It was the 1980s, and concrete was poured into my identities that held for decades. Eventually, we moved our family to the Washington, D.C. suburbs, and I worked for the Navy as a contractor, then as a federal civilian. In 2016, my friend group expanded, and I heard about experiences far different from mine, including firsthand accounts of race relations in America. Everyone had a seminal story. I began reading different authors, listening to people I hadn't before, and asking questions I had never dared to ask. The truths I was learning clashed with the stories foundational to my identities. I began asking about the history that wasn't taught in school. In An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Revisioning History, by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, I was sickened to read that the United States was populated with between 5 and 15 million Native American people when the settlers arrived, and a mere 237,000 in the 1900 U.S. Census. The number of broken treaties by the U.S. government was staggering. As per my practice, I read some of the one-star reviews on Amazon, where a commenter wrote that the book is full of half-truths. If this was the case, and 50% of the book was wrong, what do I do with the other 50% that is correct? The numbers and facts were still overwhelming. Today, the book has a 4.7-star rating and over 5,000 reviews. In The Color of Law, Richard Rothstein recounts the impact the legal practice of neighborhood covenants and redlining had on preventing black buyers from purchasing homes and deceitful practices that decimated property values. How is a black family supposed to build generational wealth when redlining is legal? The questions abound. In Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America, author Melissa Harris Perry writes that black women are the canary in the coal mine in America. She explains that due to the hierarchical structure of power, black women experience the ills of the country most acutely. This is demonstrated in the current disparities between black and white maternal death rates, infant mortality, and preterm birth rates. This was shocking, as many of the new friends and co-workers were Black women, and I had never understood this reality. I questioned how this knowledge would inform my understanding of the lived experiences of the Black women around me. My beloved church was laid bare in Jamara Tisby's The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. The American church distributed copies of the Negro Bible that excluded biblical texts that might inspire liberation and hope, like the Exodus story, while emphasizing scriptures of obedience to strengthen the grip of enslavement. The church stripped out the message of grace experienced in life on earth. Tisby writes, "Whether some Christians felt conflicted or remorseful about their support of slavery matters little. The practice continued, as did the suffering." I wondered what tendrils this endorsement of state-sanctioned terror might have in today's sanctuaries. Each Sunday, I listened to the preached gospel, but there was no condemnation of laws that disproportionately affected my Black sisters and brothers sitting next to me. I leaned in closely, and the silence was deafening. Why didn't Black service members get access to the GI Bill after returning from the World Wars? How is the Republican adoption of the Southern strategy to disenfranchise Black voters starting in the 1950s still functioning? I started to see systems at work I had previously been blind to, and I'm still uncertain if it was accidental or if, seeing indications, I chose to look away. I began to notice a stratification in the world around me, characterized by class, race, and power. Then, in 2020, this truth was perfectly captured in Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents, by Isabel Wilkerson. It is a remarkable work that has a 4.8-star rating with 47,000 reviews on Amazon. A snapshot of additional authors filling my bookshelf who continue to chisel the scales from my eyes include James Baldwin, Nikki Giovanni, Clint Smith, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Christina Sharp, Rezma Manakim, C. Van Woodward, James W. Lowen, Toni Morrison, Angela Davis, Frederick Douglass, Octavia Butler, Ta-Nehisi Coates, William Lloyd Garrison, Ibram X. Kendi, and the list could go on. I am grateful and indebted to the expanding body of work available to learn from if one has the courage. The teachings that form my identities had taught me to love my neighbor and stand up for the oppressed, that all of our laws were just, and if you just pull hard enough on those bootstraps, the American dream is yours. I had always believed that the United States had moved beyond race being a factor in the lives of its citizens, but now, looking at the data, I learned that was not the case. I question, how can this country move forward if we don't embrace the truth? I was tired of being lied to sustain the myth. Between 1882 and 1968, there were 3,446 reported lynchings of Black people in the United States. I looked at examples of the lynching postcards sent through the mail. The domestic terrorism enacted upon Black citizens was horrific in and of itself, but it wasn't the ugliest part. Families would race from the church, grab their picnic baskets, and go watch the lynching. Spectators would often cut off pieces of bodies and clothing as souvenirs or keepsakes. I will always remember the story of Mary Turner and the lynching rampage of 1918. You can look that up on your own, and don't look away. This is where I had to really slow down to let this process take hold throughout my body and understand that this had happened to fellow humans in my country and was not ancient history. Let that sink in for a moment before we move on. It's hard, but stick with it. As a reminder, recounting this journey encapsulates several years of reading, learning, and processing. It was all painful and necessary. Now, let's step out for a moment and think about how hard it is for you when you have changed your mind about something you held dear. remember a political view, a relationship, a religious doctrine, or some belief that became part of your identity and then needed to change. Making these changes is extremely difficult, and it takes time. Relationships break, emotions run hot, and there may be financial entanglements that need to be sorted out. All of these other factors are not easy to disentangle. Let's return to the picnic basket. This is a festive community event that relishes in the celebration and integration. All generations are present, with children learning from their parents and grandparents, solidifying their worldview. Remember, change is hard and takes a long time. Legislation doesn't change hearts and minds the moment the ink is dry. As I mentioned, the last documented lynching was 1968. I was born in 1970. Where did all the people sitting on picnic blankets go? Did we expect the passage of the Civil Rights Act to change all the deep-seated hatred and bigotry? Recently, a photograph of Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones resurfaced, showing him in a crowd fighting against school segregation. The woman who accused a 14-year-old Emmett Till of whistling at her, which resulted in his kidnapping, torture, and murder, died less than 2 years ago in 2023. Those kids on picnic blankets are now our grandparents and respected elders whose families adore them. Unless these elders repudiate their former selves, the residue remains. Consider how this residue might coat the rest of our society in both visible and unseen ways. A very hard reality was the unspoken underpinning of everything I had learned. Resmaa Manakeem defines white body supremacy as a societal construct where the white body is established as the supreme standard for measuring the humanity of all bodies, both structurally and philosophically. This foundational truth was the answer to explaining why all the other pillars of society were standing. The church was protecting this construct with their white, brown-haired, blue-eyed Jesus preserved in stained glass. It explained the abundance of white bodies in the seats of political power and boardrooms. I could now see why the push is to other those who don't fit the description. All the pieces fell into place, but once seen, it can't be unseen. Repentance is a primary doctrine of the Christian tradition and a pivotal moment in any Christian's life. This is when a convert turns away from their sins with the intent of no longer repeating, then puts their complete trust in God. This is a critical step to being reconciled to God. Christianity, being the bedrock of the American experience, was part of my belief system, so I went looking for evidence of repentance and was found wanting. The country enshrined the enslavement of human beings in legal documents. The enslaved were promised 40 acres and a mule for their labors, but the promise went unfulfilled. Meanwhile, enslavers received restitution for the loss of their, quote, property. We have national memorials all through the country, and I hope there was some place of national mourning for the millions of lives stolen in pursuit of free labor. Nope. Nothing. Reparations were paid to Japanese Americans after unjust internment camps during World War II, but nothing to the family of the lives stolen by the government-sanctioned enslavement and the follow-on terror of Jim Crow laws. It's hard to see the Christian doctrine at work. When asked about progress in America, Malcolm X stated, "If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, that's not progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. Progress is healing the wound that the blow made. Right now, they won't even admit the knife is even there." In 2025, considerable energy is invested in erasing this history. I am a simpleton, and the energy to overcome the cognitive dissonance of every interaction is too much for me to handle. The Bible says to love my neighbor and my enemy. That seems to be, well, everyone. The Constitution states that all men are created equal. I have only one interpretation of all. I twice took an oath to defend the Constitution. I voted expecting that we were speedily becoming a more perfect union for all. I have tinnitus, and tuning my hearing for white body supremacist dog whistles is exhausting, and I won't do it. I don't come from a long line of abolitionists, or even anyone who would talk about all the truths I've learned. I've spent long days being angry at my ancestors for not doing the required work in their lifetimes. My social media feed is full of inspirational quotes about the entrepreneurial hustle, but the algorithm doesn't amplify those seeking systemic change of equality for marginalized people. Seeing through the myth was liberating. All my American heroes, whom I idolized, had feet of clay and were fallible humans. This was incredibly good news, because that meant that the marble monuments I walked among in D.C., enshrining those who had done consequential things, were human, just like you and me. Revering these leaders as demigods meant I had incorporated them into my identity and mythos of what it meant to be patriotic. I had to defend and justify their flaws, which was unfair to their humanity and made my identity fragile. This quaking at midlife offered a decision. Cling to crumbling identities or courageously question assumptions. Albeit on wobbly legs, I chose courage. On Monday, May 25th, 2020, just like everyone else in the country, I rewatched the clip of George Floyd being murdered. Constraining my horror to social media comments was not possible. I called a buddy who had a printing company. I needed a sign. The following Sunday, May 31st, I completed my first of 101 weeks of walking every street and alley in Washington, D.C., wearing a 3-foot by 3-foot sandwich board sign that read, "Black and Brown Lives Matter." I was out to be an encouragement to those who the project resonated with, and have discussions with anyone who wanted to talk. I committed to walking one day a week until I completed the task. I projected 2 years. I could have found other ways to complete it quicker, but the primary metric was conversations, not speed. Most passers-by assumed I was just a middle-aged white guy out earning my liberal brownie points. While the physical characteristics may have been actual, the interior was not. I was a straight-ticket conservative from 1988 through 2016, a Navy veteran, an evangelical Christian, and someone who followed the rules. I had spent nearly half a century despising liberals and quickly became despised by conservatives each time I slipped on the sign. I had never protested anything and was scared of climbing out of my car to start the walk. I had planned for the worst and hoped for the best. Spare glasses, phone, keys, and ID remained in the car, and my belt could be used as a tourniquet if needed. After each walk, I would post a reflection, pictures, and a GPS map of the walk to social media. I wasn't in the best of physical shape, and it wasn't until around week 10 that I could do the day's walk without being nearly crippled the following day. This was during the pandemic, and I spent weekdays sedentary at my home office, then walked 20-plus miles a day on the weekend. This was not optimal, and I paid for it with an aching body. I learned how to sweat, read the weather, and listen for the changes in wind coming through the trees to grab the sign and try to decapitate me. My wife was supportive, but concerned about my safety. Bringing home a sweet from Wagshell's Deli seemed to take some of the edge off of me being gone each week. I told my grown kids about the plan. My local son came out to join me for a couple of hours and got a picture with a supporter 1 week. My daughter, who was off to college, cheered me on from afar. I wrote notes to myself to remember names, conversations, and specific events to jog my memory after I got home. The deeper I got into the walk, the more liberally I took pictures of anything that caught my eye. However, I didn't record any conversations or video, as I wanted those I spoke with to feel as free as possible when discussing sensitive topics. While I walked 131 D.C. neighborhoods The nation and the world, pent up from COVID-19 pandemic restrictions, erupted with protests seeking social justice and police reform. The shooting deaths of EMT Breonna Taylor and jogger Ahmaud Arbery further ignited the clashes to bring about equity and equality. It felt like every other week there was another human being who became a hashtag. Companies and politicians made massive promises and pledges that proved to be empty when the promissory note was delivered. Today, the backlash and scorched earth practices seek to erase any progress made over the last 60 years. I learned no group is a monolith. I moved at the speed of conversation and encouraged and angered all kinds of folks, black, white, brown, rich, and poor. Everyone had an opinion about what I was doing. I have always struggled with fearing what others thought of me. I always wanted to be liked. This walk was a frontal attack on the lifelong urge to be a people pleaser. As the weeks progressed, it got easier to handle the blowback from those who disagreed. The vast majority of negative comments were similar. A popular one screamed out of window was, "White Lives Matter," to which I responded, "No one said they didn't. If I'm having a conversation about my fictional son Billy's broken leg, why must I talk about his brother Bobby like he has the same issue?" There were lots of drive-by comments about destroying the country. The data says a significant portion of society does not experience equity. I was walking to bring attention to this fact so that it can be addressed rather than being neglected. Raymond Coates saw me walking down his alley and invited me into his backyard for a break and a chat. He had spent time in the infamous Lorton Prison in Virginia and was well-versed in history. After nearly 5 hours of eating lunch, sitting through a rain shower, and discussing seemingly every topic we could, I headed out to finish the day's walk. Walking up a shady, cool, dead-end alley, a woman walking the other way said, "Hello, Mr. Officer, because there's no way a white man carrying that sign through my neighborhood is not a cop." On another day, a pair of neighbors were sure I was CIA and gave me a baggie of fresh figs for the road. I was aware every day I wore my sign that my 6-foot-tall, short haircut, middle-aged white male body carried a level of protection, or to use another word, privilege, as I moved through neighborhoods. I spoke to the police when I walked by, but I was not aware of anyone calling them to report that I was casing their neighborhood. As quoted earlier, some people had me pegged for a police officer. I know that if a black or Arab man tried to complete the same mission, people would have called 911 and the police would have sought him out multiple times. As a veteran, I served so everyone could have the same freedom to express their constitutional right. The walk represented the desire for everyone to be able to freely do what I did. Additionally, I had the resources of time and money to do the walk. I wasn't working a weekend job to make ends meet and didn't need to use public transportation to get to each walk. Buddy Harrison had spent time in prison and became a close friend. He was proud of the free food pantry he had established and kept stocked, located in a field across from his house, as well as the boxing gym he ran to help neighborhood youth stay off the streets. Sadly, he was gunned down on his front porch in September of 2023. This one hurt. A couple streets over, a woman started our conversation by leaning out of her window with the question, "Are you packing?" To which I didn't immediately understand what she meant. After an explanation, I replied, "No." I didn't carry weapons, as I knew it would compromise the open-hearted vulnerability I carried as my defense. I was trusting that if God was protecting me, then he would steer me down alleys when nothing nefarious was happening and just come back later after it was safe. Plenty of folks spoke prayers and blessings over me during the walk. The most credible threat was from a black man who didn't like my smile nor my sign. He threatened multiple times to send the largest dog I had ever seen to attack me if I continued down his block. As he restrained his dog, I tried twice to appeal, but the threat remained, and I turned around, scared. The day before my final walk, I returned and completed the 50-foot segment of road I had missed as a result of this interaction. And for the record, yeah, I was nervous. Walking through a predominantly black neighborhood, a white guy, a few years older than me, wearing a navy ball cap, carrying most of his possessions on his back, asked for a couple of dollars. By that time, I was out of cash, but tried to learn more about his story nonetheless. Over a 15-minute conversation, he oscillated between begging for money and pulling out his empty hand to make a pistol and threatening to shoot me in the head. Soon enough, the neighbors pulled out their cell phones to record the spectacle of these two middle-aged white guys, one wearing this large yellow sign and the other screaming into his face, threatening to shoot him with an imaginary gun, and calling him a white, blue-eyed devil. For the record, we're both white, and both have blue eyes. After parting, I wiped a spittle from my face. I still laugh at the absolute absurdity of the scene, and surprise someone's cell phone video still hasn't made it to YouTube. An app tracked my steps to ensure I covered every street and alley. After over 4 million steps, the distance from Washington, D.C. to Las Vegas, with the longest daily walk being 28.6 miles, 1,300 conversations, with Raymond being the longest, 5 pairs of shoes, and remarkably, no parking tickets or muggings. I finished the walk on the now-removed Black Lives Matter Plaza in front of the White House. Additional lessons learned. Reflective white crosswalk paint is slick in the rain, and water freezes on it before it does the blacktop. During a long walk, porta-potties at construction sites are a legitimate lifesaver. Wearing a sandwich board on a windy day really sucks. White people don't have the language to talk about racism and equality. Splitting the district into black, white, and diverse neighborhoods, my data was stark. In black neighborhoods, I averaged 28 conversations a day. In diverse communities, there were 15. And in white neighborhoods, I averaged 4 conversations per day. And this was in progressive D.C. I can only imagine what this metric would look like elsewhere. Walking through the neighborhoods, it was evident where redlining had previously occurred, as indicated by the level of infrastructure in the built environment. I witnessed the beautiful homes, which indicated great wealth, and the creative beauty in the more impoverished neighborhoods. A 30-something white guy asked if I could regularly walk his wealthy neighborhood, as he had witnessed his white neighbors yell at black runners as they tracked their runs through his streets. For folks that look like me, this whole conversation that needs to be had feels like a chore. For others, it's a matter of survival. The list of those whom I have learned from is expansive, whether in person, through podcasts, social media, movies, documentaries, or books. During that lengthy conversation with Raymond Coates, there was a point where he leaned back with a big smile and said, "You think you got something to say, don't you?" Kind of picture Denzel Washington in Training Day. And I replied, "I think I do, and I'm still working out what it is." Now, I made mistakes. I responded to a young man's comment, and only after he was out of earshot did my brain process what he actually had said. And I realized my comment was hurtful. It was too late to catch him and correct the error. I wrote him a public apology on Instagram describing my error. I'm sure he will never see it. In talking with a community organizer, I made a comment dripping with ignorance and privilege. In hindsight, for the whole walk, I should have been more connected with neighborhood communities. I struggled with walking the tightrope of not wanting to draw attention away from other protest activities and knowing when to insert myself into the conversation. A month before completing the project, Teresa Vargas, a reporter from the Washington Post, published a story about the walk, and I appreciated how she handled the story. The range of comments reflected the support and hatred I had experienced in the streets. I was to walk past a group of black residents, sitting in chairs on the lawn as I moved up the sidewalk. We started talking, and a woman about my age asked if I was racist. Her friends jumped to my defense, scoffing at the idea because, after all, I was wearing the sign and doing the project. She said this didn't prove anything and proceeded to pepper me with question after question. Then she pressed me hard, demanding to know what this project would actually accomplish. How was it going to make a difference in her life? I told her I didn't have a clear, snappy answer. I explained that when I was done, the project would give me a seat at the table to challenge those who looked like me or held positions of power and press them to do more. I told her I would say, "I may not be the sharpest tool in the shed, and perhaps you disagree with what I've done, but I used the tools at my disposal and set a baseline. For 2 years, I walked and talked through the heat, rain, and ice for 907 hours and 53 minutes, spent roughly $10,000, put myself in danger, and utilized everything I could to make a difference. Now, since you are more intelligent, wealthier, and more connected, I charge you to utilize your unique talents and resources to bring about the changes that have been so long in coming, because I'm confident you'll do it better. Don't do another walk. It has been done." I explained that the jury is out on the full impact of the walk until after I'm dead. Whatever I produce in my life will be put on the scale in due time. This is a work that will not be accomplished in my lifetime, but I will not be an ancestor who does nothing. If I had documented this remarkable woman's name, I should have, I would tell her that I think about her righteous challenge every week, and this podcast episode is another step in that journey. I traded myth for truth and learned a great deal about Washington, D.C., its people, myself, and the journey ahead for this country to fulfill the promises enshrined in the documents and ideals we hold dear. One guy chased me down and said, "I figured you had lost a bet, were crazy, or were very committed," and he wanted clarity. I assured him there was no wagers involved. However, I think the truth is a mix of the others. I don't have it all figured out. Biases remain. I keep learning, stumbling, getting it wrong, and needing others to speak into my life for correction. I sat on porches with those who had marched during the civil rights movement and glad they were enjoying their lemonade and sitting this one out. Their turn marching is long over, and the baton is passed to a new generation. It wasn't until I stepped out of my insulated bubble that I learned about organizations leading in these conversations. If you look like me, don't burden others to explain the things that a book or a podcast can answer, and don't ask those in marginalized communities to do the work for free. I've included in the show notes a list of additional resources I have learned from. The list is long. The people are remarkable, and there is work to be done. Fill your social media feed with those doing this work and start listening to understand. The concrete solidifying my former identities has been obliterated. I have lost community and relationships. Gone is the certainty of faith, and my voting record has changed. Close friends have disappeared into their lives. Building new networks has been slow, but no slower than establishing the original friendships. There are so many answers I do not have, and yet I am finding solace and community in the land of questions. The bend of the moral arc of the universe towards justice will not happen on its own, but rather it will be bent by the effort of regular people with clay feet stepping up to take their turn pulling and heaving it into place. There is a space for you, and your descendants are expecting you to solve our issues now. Thank you for doing your part. Yeah, I know it's a lot. Thank you for holding space and witnessing. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures that we're engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.